Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
The thing with photographs is that they only capture a second. Nothing before, nothing after. And in the course of a life, it's not much. And yet we read so much into that second and freight it with meaning. I'm looking at a crumpled up photo of me aged maybe 5, so around about 1975. And it's suitably sepia. We're on holidays in Kerry, Waterville actually, and we've just met or bumped into the legendary Mick O'Dwyer at his garage. His name's over the door, and in the background of the photo, a black Ford Anglia, JIN 57. There's an old Castrol oil sign over the door. My Uncle Chris, a proud Galway man, is beside me, and my father is wearing his usual sports jacket, just out of shot. My mother, I imagine, is taking the photograph, and I have to say it's one of her best. And there's me, squinting into the sun, mustard-coloured polo shirt and brown polyester shorts. I look slightly confused because I've been scooped up by Micko. Now, I'm not sure whether Micko was only a four-time All-Ireland winning Kerry player when this photo was taken, or if he'd won the first of his 8 All-Irelands as Kerry manager at this stage. Anyway, he has a polo shirt and thick black hair, and his hands are the size of my face. His eyes are shaded, but he looks like he could hop me and punt me over the bar. I want to know more about the minutes before and after the photo, but Micko and Chris and my dad are all gone. Did we just happen to be passing through Waterville? Did we stand around like fans waiting for Micko to appear? Did my dad go in and ask for him? When the great composer Joseph Haydn met a young upstart called Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, he famously told Mozart's father, "Before God and as an honest man, I tell you that your son is the greatest composer known to me, either in person or by name." And similarly, do you think Micko might have said, "My God, Sean Toll, that lad of yours will surely lift Sam Maguire someday"? We can only imagine, but I like to think he might have. He had a great eye for talent, and my father's day would have been made. The closest I ever came to winning an All-Ireland was in September 2002, when my namesake, but no relation, John Toll, played on the victorious Armagh team. 2 weeks later, I got a letter to my address from a Belfast sports injury clinic, addressed to John Toll, that began, "Firstly, John, huge congratulations on winning the All-Ireland. What a tremendous achievement. Now I recommend we get back to look at a course of treatment for your injury." I put the letter in the back of a drawer in the bedroom, thinking that someday in the future, long after I'm gone, someone will be sifting through the detritus of my life, will stumble on the letter and exclaim, "Jesus, he kept that quiet. I never knew he won in All-Ireland." My birthday was in September, and often as a present, Dad and I would head down to Dublin to a final. Now, to this day, nothing else in the known world is as like hen's teeth as All-Ireland final tickets, apart from actual hen's teeth, of course. Even as a child, I could tell that things would be looking grim on the Wednesday and Thursday. And then there'd be a flurry of phone calls coming through from a mysterious underground network known only to my father on the Friday and Saturday night. "Meet me at the Skylawn. The tickets are in the North Star Hotel in Amiens Street. 12:30. Don't be late." Hurling or football, we didn't mind. And me and my dad heard Joe Connolly making his "Tadini Arash in Aliyev agus Glunder in Agree" speech. We watched from the top deck of the Hogan as Seamus Darby ruined Kerry's 5 in a row in 1982. And by the time Down won it on a glorious day in 1991, I was kind of past the chalk ices and raging for pints at that stage. I wasn't playing football, and my chance at All-Ireland glory was gone. But had things been different, I think I might have thanked Mikko in my speech and regaled the nation live on TV with the story of that split second in Waterville in the 1970s where I was touched by the hand of God. And if that other John Toole wants the letter, he can fight me for it.
As I was going over the Crooked Carry Mountains, I saw Captain Pharaoh and his money.
As I walked off the pitch at Clonus following the Ulster final celebrations last year, I saw him. The big man, Michael Murphy. He was outside the press box after completing the commentary for the game, having retired from playing himself in 2022. Donegal had won on penalties following a titanic battle with Armagh. As he kindly posed for a photograph, I looked up into his face. "Michael, Donegal are Ulster champions. Can you believe it?" "Oh, I can believe it," came the quick reply as he gazed out over the Clonus grass. "But would you ever come back?" was the unspoken question on my lips. I thought it was too personal a thing to ask, but I was longing to ask him. It was the missing piece of the puzzle following Jim McGuinness's unexpected return as manager the year previously. A few months later, I decided to help things along a bit when I slipped a note under the door of the Michael Murphy Sports Shop in Letterkenny. My note had the words, "Come back, Michael," written on it in capital letters. I'd just been to the inspiring one-woman show Jimmy's Winning Matches in the local theatre and felt compelled to take some small action to influence the direction of my county's footballing future. In November of that year, I was astonished to read a headline confirming that Michael Murphy had indeed decided to return to the inter-county scene. My note must have had a little part to play in his decision, I like to think. And now, here we are facing into another All-Ireland final. Having seen Donegal lift the Sam Maguire twice in my lifetime so far, I've often heard supporters talking of the little rituals or superstitions they follow in the lead-up to a big game. They try with scientific accuracy to recreate the conditions of the last big win, cutting the grass or not, wearing their glasses or lucky jersey, or even the right underwear. My own personal favourite is a ritual I have practised for quite a while now. Every time I'm driving to a Donegal match, I play at full volume Ennio Morricone's rousing composition, The Ecstasy of Gold. While I listen, I let my imagination run loose, with battle-like scenarios of close calls, games turning on their heads in an instant, and of course, at the climax, images of the team rejoicing, winning, fans sharing in the euphoria. A huge crowd of fans feeling good can raise the decibels at a game and give the team that little extra encouragement to get over the line when the margins are tight. When the chips are down, the Donegal chants go up. I always think three syllables are required for a good chant. Indeed, Michael Murphy's return has already been making big noise pitch side. Even when he's taken off field during a game, the resulting cheers and standing ovation are worth another few points to the Donegal scoreboard. Being there, shouting until my voice is hoarse, cheering, celebrating, commiserating, on good days and bad, through thick and thin, I've found that life and football are like two sides of the one coin. When times get hard, we must dig all the deeper, pull together and find that extra gear. Sometimes we fold under the pressure, cry out in pain, and sometimes we weep tears of pure joy. In my own life, in knockbacks, in losing a mother to dementia, in marrying the love of my life, in getting the job I want, in giving birth to two beautiful babies, in losing babies, football has been with me through all these times, allowing me to express joy, pain, and everything in between. At the All-Ireland semi-final this year, I gave Michael another standing ovation as Jim McGuinness took him off in the second half of the game against Meath, a very good sign that the boss is happy. With a winning scoreline of 326 to 15 points, that's not surprising. Giddy Donegal fans bounced out of Croke Park after the hooter sounded in an All-Ireland final for the first time in 11 years. Sitting in the heavy post-match traffic on the way home, flags were waved out windows and Las Vegas in the hills of Donegal played on car stereos. As for me, Ennio Morricone will be playing for one more time in my car this year. On my way to Croke Park today. One game left.
There was no electric light on the Aran Islands when I first heard Leonard Cohen sing. Sean Lamas was 2 years out of power when I first heard Leonard Cohen sing. There were buses on Grafton Street when I first heard Leonard Cohen sing. The song I first heard Leonard Cohen sing was The Sisters of Mercy, and it appeared as one track on an LP called The Rock Machine Turns You On. The use of psychedelic drugs implicit in the title of the album was unknown to me, but the record company obviously thought it was a good slogan for selling to young people a sampler of the best rock music it had to offer in 1968. Not that Leonard Cohen was a rock group, he was simply a man singing to his own Spanish guitar accompaniment with a little help from an unobtrusive keyboard. His song, The Sisters of Mercy, was a shock to those of us who had been educated by religious orders. It seemed to be about a poor soul who had got lost, spiritually or physically, and had sought refuge in a convent. We who knew the Sisters of Mercy and the Sisters of Charity and the Sacred Heart nuns and the Holy Child nuns were disconcerted at the news that, as well as taking him in and feeding him, they might, he hinted, take care of other needs too. It is true that he said we weren't lovers like that, but he went on to say ambiguously, but besides, it would still be all right. Cohen then must have been in his early 30s, though he seemed really old. In the year 2010, Leonard Cohen is really old, but he is still dangerous and exciting. On the feast of St. Ignatius Loyola, on the shore of Sligo Bay, he crouches down on one knee to start a song, or to encourage the terrific player of the Spanish guitar-like instrument, and has no trouble getting up again. He does a little hop and a skip off the stage, like the Katzenjammer kids, before coming back for an encore. He sings, "I want to explore every lovely inch of you," and we believe him. There are three fine-looking women singing along with him, providing a range of voices that is beyond his, a heavenly choir. This is a 75-year-old man, and there is hope for us all. Cohen has a habit in concerts of reciting words of a song in his slow, sonorous, deep voice before singing the song. "Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." This Zen thought seemed especially to the point as our economic world fell to pieces around us. I thought I saw the former chairman of one of the big banks queuing up for a gourmet burger, or was it a beaker of organic champagne, at one of the stalls set up between the sea and the grey limestone hulk of the house where Constance Gore Booth grew up. This was a man who had previously been happy to live in the limelight. Now he seemed to want to recline into the shadows, not be recognised. But then maybe it was a night for shape-shifting. As I walked around through the crowd before the concert, in my peaked cap made of straw, a local man came up to me, stared into my eyes and said, "Are you Mr. Cohen?" On stage, later, the real Mr. Cohen spoke again. "The light of evening, Lissadel. Great windows open to the south. Two girls in silk kimonos, both beautiful, one a gazelle." He spoke of how privileged he was to be playing here and to recall the man who wrote those lines. He thanked us for our hospitality. And when he inserted a local reference into the song Hallelujah, "I didn't come to the Yeats country to fool ya," we who had sat for 4 hours in the light drizzle listening shouted Yahoo and whistled with our fingers. The back roads of North Sligo around Lissadel on the summer night as we cycled home from the Leonard Cohen concert were not as black as the blackness of Kilmervie and Ochil on Inishmore in the late 1960s, but the bicycle lamps were as ineffectual now as they were then. And even the light of the half moon was not enough to show you someone walking along the road until you saw their shadow and were almost on top of them. The answer, ring those bells that still can ring.
Yeah, my friends are gone and my hair is grey. I ache in the places where I used to play. And I'm crazy for love, but I'm not coming on.
It's the morning of the 2022 All-Ireland football final between Kerry and Galway. As we sit in the team bus, I'm brought back to my own days as a player. My sport was hurling. Clare, my county. Now I sit surrounded by different colours, the green and gold of Kerry. My role as a coach has been to prepare the players for the psychological demands of playing at the highest level. But nothing really prepares you for the biggest day of them all, the All-Ireland final. The low murmur of conversation fills the air behind me. These young men are about to play in the biggest game of their lives. Some of them are already household names. David Clifford and his brother Paddy, Shawnee O'Shea, Tom O'Sullivan, Tadhg Morley, Paul Ganey, the Spillanes, Jason Foley. Very few of these lads have All-Ireland medals yet. In Kerry, this is like being a hen that won't lay. Yet all over the country and beyond, they are recognised as icons, legends, names that will live forever because of the kind of players they are. But I don't just see what others see. I see boys playing with their friends in back gardens, windswept club pitches and freshly cut hayfields across the Kingdom of Kerry. I see the young men I've come to know behind the public personas, the teammates who have trusted me with their stories, their struggles, the ups and downs of their lives. I've eaten in their homes, been cared for by their families. I've grown to love them like younger brothers. The bus races through each red traffic light, hustled along by the Garda escort. The Galway supporters, in their maroon and white jerseys, look on in amusement. Some boo and stick their thumbs down. But the Kerry supporters, recognising their heroes, begin to cheer. As we get closer, the crowd swells and our advance is slowed. One man catches my eye, red-faced from a summer of sunshine. He lifts his son in his green and gold jersey into the air and onto his shoulders. We stop momentarily as the crowd is cleared from the road. I watch the man's eyes fill with tears. Is he remembering his own father, lifting him high as a boy himself many years ago. I feel a lump forming in my throat. I'm not even from Kerry, but Jack O'Connor and these players and the backroom team who care so much about them have burrowed their way into my heart. As we turn onto Jones's Road, a wall of sound hits the bus like a high tide hitting Ventry Pier. It's a sea of maroon and white and green and gold out there. The chatter of the lads recedes. A silence settles over them, each in their own private cauldron of emotions. Some embrace it. Others stick earphones in and try to block it all out. A few bite their nails. We weave the last 100 yards into Croke Park and under the Hogan Stand to the dressing rooms. Cullum, our kit man, has already been here for 2 hours and has everything set up. Each player's place is marked by their neatly hung jersey, their name and their chosen quote emblazoned on the wall above their seat. There's a flurry of activity, lads getting their ankles strapped, their shoulders reinforced with tape, the last warm-up rubs from the physios. In one corner, the starting goalie and his replacement, both named Shane, discuss tactics with the backs. Across the room, the midfielders and forwards do the same. The air is tense with anticipation as lads embrace each other, wishing one another luck. We move to the warm-up area. I can't help getting involved, still trapped in that time a decade ago when I would have gripped my hurley in my hand. Today, it's a tackle bag I hold firm, a target to help each player prepare for the battle that's coming. Big Joe O'Connor hits me with his shoulder, almost driving me through the wall. Adrian Spillane slams into me, shaking me to the core. One after the other they come, the intensity increasing with each impact. Just then, a thundering roar erupts in the stadium. Galway have run out onto the field. Is this how the gladiators felt before they entered the Colosseum to face the lions? The knock comes at the door. It's time. Jack O'Connor calls everyone to gather around him. Players, coaches, all shoulder to shoulder, arms locked in solidarity, protected by a force field of belief and determination. Last to speak is Shawnee O'Shea, the spiritual leader of the team, his eyes on fire. I'd follow that man into any battle, I think to myself, as the door is thrown open and the Kerry team run out to meet their destiny.
Caravan. You told me to keep an eye out for Keating's bread van, to tell you immediately when it was coming down the road, and you'd give me the money to go and get a fresh loaf. I kicked my ball around the place and played marbles with the boys from the other caravans, and sure forgot all about the important arrival. The fresh bread was all sold out by the time we went down to get some.
"Your father will be mad," my mother said. "He'll have to drive into Castle Gregory now to get a loaf, and he after a hard day's work." "No matter," says I. "Sure, he can go for a pint while he's at it."
I got a clip around the ear for that. Next morning, the bread was stale anyway, and we made toast from it.
Morning, all. I'd like to tell you about when I was a young boy. Must have been 3 or 4 months old at the time. I didn't really know what I wanted, and if I did, I wouldn't have been able to tell anybody because all I could do was gurgle. So I sat there in my high chair, thinking one day, looking at me tray and thinking, what I'd give for a meal on there. So I started looking around to see what I could have.
Donegal, pride of all. The week after the GAA semi-final match, Donegal versus Meath, everywhere I went, I could hear conversations. Were you at the match? Or were you watching? Weren't they powerful? There was a sense of collective joy. The county is full of supporters and there are signs and flags everywhere. The air feels lighter. Donegal, pride of all. As I watched the semi-final, I loved how the commentators named the home teams of each player as they were in motion. A ribbon of Donegal towns, Glenswilly, St. Eunan's, Sean McCool's, Neave Connell, St. Noll's, Kilcara, Nakilibega, Neave Padraic, St. Michael's, Carndonagh, Red Hughes, Gidor, Buncrana, Rialtnamara and Clohanilly. The litany of those clubs where summer camps are now happening for boys and girls, where football and hurling teams are training from under eights to senior levels, where coaches give up their spare time for the players, where parents, grandparents and guardians stand at pitch sides during all types of weather, and where all the voluntary workers look after the pitches, kits, schedules, fundraising and so much more. Donegal, pride of all. What it is to cheer for the team in Croke Park, or at a gathering in a club or bar, watching at home, or listening in from Australia, New Zealand, Dubai, or so many far-flung places. When Oisin Gallen, Kieran Moore, and Conor O'Donnell scored semi-final goals, did you hear the roar of the crowds from Balbuffet, Remelton, and Carndonagh? Did you hear me roar? This All-Ireland final game carries so much history with it. When Donegal beat Dublin in 1992, there was a joyful sense of shock all around the country. We had been the unknown quantity at the time. We all were invested in the result. The team members became superstars. That year, my husband and our two eldest sons, of 8 and 10 years old, were gifted 3 prize tickets for Croke Park. I was at home, holding a small baby, and I danced with joy when they won. Now I think of those who have aged, those who are still with us, those who we now hold in memory, and those who weren't even born in 1992. So many memories still swirling around in the ether. My son, Aidan, remembers training 6 years later for the St. Eunan's under-14s team. As the boys trained, the coach's 8-year-old son was always there with his father. The boy would stay at a nearby pitch and practice away by himself, kicking the ball over and over, trying to score in the net from different angles. I wonder, did Mick Murphy know then that his son Michael would become the star player? In the 2012 final at Croke Park against Mayo, Michael Murphy, the team captain, scored a goal after 2 minutes and 25 seconds. You must have heard the roar of joy from the county then. We were no longer the minnows. I've always said if I didn't live in Donegal, I would want to live in Donegal. The wild beauty of the county and the mysticism that surrounds it. But mostly, the real lives that are lived there. The joys, friendships and strengths, and also the hardships withstood. The many families that have endured crumbling homes and their fight to be heard. The losses and tragedies. Jim McGuinness, of all people, can testify to those. His own personal story epitomises what it is to survive and thrive, to lead a county onward. Donegal, pride of all. We were in Croke Park in 2014. I can still hear the Kerry supporter seated behind us shouting, "Thy kingdom come," all through the game. When Kerry won, it felt like a shock, but it wasn't a catastrophe. Donegal, GAA, was already on the map. The man of the match for the 2025 semi-final was Finbar Rorty. He is 19 years old. He was 6 in 2012 when heroes were made. And this is the wonder. the mix of ages and experiences, the sheer work ethic throughout the football team and their management team, the passion of the supporters, and how it all comes together to blend the spirit of Donegal, past and future. When the team bus travels to Croke Park, it'll be carrying history, joys and disappointments, memories, hopes and determination for the county. Donegal, pride of all. And yes, Jimmy's winning matches.
Radio games. You still bring me to places, sunny seaside car parks where the grass was as hot as the sand, to an army of hard-working fathers fulfilling Sunday obligations when holidays lasted only one day, twisting wire coat hangers into a variety of antenna, no two the same, a steel-grey sea of reception so that your lyrical tone would not be broken and the inexplicable marvel that was radio waves could travel from Dublin to the wing of a Morris 1100 uninterrupted. Marriage vows put to the test with pleas of try it now, an 89.6, not the whole way to 90. Car doors wide open like a mighty flock of multicoloured guillemots about to take flight. The occupiers blessed with your gift of bilocation. And how they flew. A murmuration of Fiats and Fords, swooping along sidelines, sailing between uprights, twitching uncontrollably on the hot leather seats, half standing, half sitting, involuntarily grasping at slitters travelling at ferocious speed. The marriage vows again strained with rolling eyes and where's the flask? Work-weary bodies at breaking point, being in two places at the one time.
On this morning's programme, we heard Mick O'Dwyer and Me by John Toll, The Ecstasy of Green and Gold by Regina Devenny, Leonard Cohen in Lissadel by John S. Doyle, The Drive-In by Tony Griffin, Caravan, a poem by Noel King, Donegal, Pride and All by Denise Blake, and Radio Games, a poem by John Cooney. This morning's music was Whiskey in the Jar, the acoustic version by Thin Lizzy, The Ecstasy of Gold by Ennio Morricone, Tower of Song by Leonard Cohen from his Live in Dublin album, To War by Cormac Begley, Toast by Street Band, and The Homes of Donegal by Paul Brady. You can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE Radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.